Edward Muybridge is one of the strangest and most significant figures in the history of photography and cinema.
What surprised me was that people didn't know about Muybridge. They knew the pictures, but they didn't know his name. This man with no name.
Born just as photography was invented, in a world changing faster than ever before, Muybridge tried to capture change.
Muybridge is reinventing himself, wanting to be a master of his own universe by stopping time, by freezing time and being able to put the pieces back together. There's something very secretive and dark about that.
His work prefigured not just cinema, but our digital age. He was artist, showman, and murderer. His story begins here in Kingston upon Thames. In 1904, right at the beginning of the century of speed, Edward Muybridge left his hometown a remarkable legacy. Now, the local museum is setting up its own show of his work to coincide with a major exhibition at Tate Britain.
Everyone thinks of him and they think of, you know, San Francisco and America. They don't think of here.
Yeah.
Not really. Now they will.
Now they will. And we think it's been established that the collection in Kingston is actually the biggest and, if not the most significant, in the world. Significant just for the fact that Muybridge chose to bequeath it to the people of Kingston on his death. He had the foresight to understand that putting it in a museum was going to preserve it for future generations. He left us a number of completely unique objects, including his original newspaper cuttings book. It charts his career from 1868 right up until his death in 1904.
Every mention, it looks like, every review, given the astonishing feats that he's presenting, some of those reviews seem to suggest that he's a rather modest man.
He would introduce himself as professor, so I don't think he was that modest. I think he was very carefully engineering a particular
image of himself.
Image of himself, and he did that all throughout his career.
So he was as careful in projecting his own image as he was projecting these images.
Absolutely,
as well.
Yeah.
He was named plain Edward Muggeridge.
He was always making up new names for himself, and it seems that the inspiration for that strange spelling of his name, Edward, comes from this coronation stone right near his home in Kingston. This is the place where Edward Muybridge was born. His mother ran a barge business from the backyard down there. The horses used to haul the grain and coal along the Thames. It was an ancient, slow world which Muybridge helped catapult into this future of new technology, where there's an image of everything and everything is an image.
The young Edward evidently did not want to go into the family business and live over the shop.
You get a rare glimpse of Muybridge growing up in this reminiscence by a younger cousin of his. She called him an eccentric boy, rather mischievous, always doing or saying something unusual or inventing a new toy or a fresh trick. When he left school, he became dissatisfied. There was nothing worth doing in Kingston, sleepy hole. He wanted adventure. The world was wide and he wanted to see it. He was going to America. My grandmother put a pile of sovereigns beside him and said, "You may be glad to have them, Ted." He pushed them back to her and said, "No, thank you, Grandma. I'm going to make a name for myself. If I fail, you will never hear of me again."
And make a name for himself he did. Many names. The 20-year-old set off across the ocean. He travelled through an America under construction and the still unexplored West. No one knows quite how he got there, but it was 5 years later that his name was first recorded on the west coast of America, territory that had only just been seized from Mexico.
So this is where he would have arrived.
Yes.
1855.
He's in a six-year-old metropolis at the end of the world, where everything is possible and nobody's decided yet what it will all become and what it will mean. So things are wide open.
And this is where gold had been discovered, isn't it? Just a few years before.
Yeah, and when the gold rush began, so many people deserted their ships to make their fortune in the mines that there was a forest of masts of abandoned ships in the harbor. So they dragged them ashore and made them into hotels and prisons, and they built the land around them. It was part of this great confusion and turmoil. The city burnt down six times in its first few years. There were hangings and duels. There were brothels. There were Chinese girls working as slaves. It was the Wild West, but it was the Wild West with opera and champagne. So it was both very elegant and sophisticated and very rough and wild. There's this wonderful ditty, "Oh, what was your name in the States? Was it Jackson or Johnson or Bates? Did you murder your wife and fly for your life? Oh, what was your name in the States? When you came to California, you were literally at the end of the world."
A young man and a foreigner in a place where everyone was young and foreign. He took on a new identity as a bookseller, name of Edward Muybridge.
Muybridge advertised himself as a furbisher of gentlemen's libraries. From Muybridge's bookstore came fine illustrated books from the London Printing Company. He's selling luxuries, not necessities. He didn't make a fortune, but he didn't go broke, and he didn't live in a filthy camp eating out of tin cans either.
He'd also been trading in engravings and photographs, images of celebrities like this murder victim. By now, he was 30 years old. Maybe he saw more of a future in images of the world than in books about it. He announced in the press that he was moving on.
"I have this day sold to my brother Thomas S. Muybridge my entire stock of books, engravings, etc. I shall leave for New York, London, Berlin, Paris, Rome, and Vienna, etc. And all orders or commissions for the purchase of works of literature or art entrusted to me will be properly attended to."
He missed the boat and set off overland towards the old world.
"I recollect taking supper at a stagecoach station on the road. We then got on board the stage, which was drawn by six wild Mustang horses. That is the last I recall of that 9 days.
His stagecoach crashed, and he sustained a serious head injury.
"When I recovered, each eye formed an individual impression so that, looking at you, for instance, I could see another man sitting by your side. He is seeing his life momentarily suspended. Here is a man who's had a near-death experience. That is quite a pivotal point in the way that he wants to relate to life and the way that he wants to freeze time."
Do you know, it's the first time I've thought of a stagecoach moving fast, suddenly stopped and you're knocked out, and you've got this moment, this frozen moment. Time stopped.
Completely.
He went back to England and didn't return for 6 years.
When he came back, he was no longer Muybridge the bookseller. He was Muybridge the photographer. He'd learned photography and learned it brilliantly and embarked on the career on which he would make his mark.
Some people have connected the obsessiveness and repetition which make his iconic images seem so modern to the trauma of the accident.
It's often the case with frontal lobe injuries that you undergo a personality change. You become disinhibited, a bit reckless, thrill-seeking. And it also often disinhibits people's creativity. But a great many people have head injuries, and very few of them become great artists.
James Bond producer Michael Wilson is a big collector of Muybridge's work.
Down here we have his early work as a photographer. He's learning his craft at this point. If we look at these lighthouse series, which he did with the Lighthouse Commission, they have this romantic feel about them. These two people, man and woman, posed on the edge. And then up here, there are people. They're all precisely posed in these pictures. And then he has these clouds here. Now, these clouds were not there at the time the picture was taken. So he had a separate negative of clouds that he would print into these pictures to give them the sort of romantic feeling of atmosphere.
Early photographers couldn't capture a subject and the sky at the same time because the sky would appear white. Clouds were added later. This wasn't the only problem. The kit was incredibly heavy and cumbersome. Muybridge had now adopted a new name, modestly calling himself Helios, the Sun. His flying studio would lug everything he needed to the location.
Muybridge would have had to take all this and a lot more, to take 20 by 24 inch plates. They were called mammoth plates. Anything larger than the span of the hand was deemed large. He'd need pack horses, several assistants, chemicals, lots of chemicals. I'm only taking whole plate negatives, which are a lot smaller. But the one drawback with this wet collodion process was that you had to process the negative while it was still in a moist state. If it dried, you'd have to start again. The photographer had to take a darkroom with him wherever he went, because he had 10 minutes from preparing the plate to taking the exposure to developing the plate afterwards.
They had to make a film of silver on the glass plate.
I will pour the plate and then rock it around here.
Muybridge reflected later.
Every photographer was his own chemist. All this involved a vast amount of tedious and careful manipulation, from which the current generation is happily relieved.
Landscape photographs taken with a wet plate process would last about a minute. Long exposures using a lens cap as the shutter. ...45 seconds, F22, back into the dark box.
I have now an outfit of lenses and apparatus superior to any other in the United States. At the suggestion of several artists and patrons of the arts, I propose devoting the approaching season to the production of large-size photographic negatives illustrating the Yosemite and other grand picturesque portions of our coast.
It was in the Yosemite Valley in California that Muybridge really made his name as a photographer. He'd become a chemist, but he had also become an artist.
He learned from European photographers, as well as from landscape painters like William Keith.
But how did Muybridge's work differentiate itself from what the other photographers were doing?
He was really interested in creating a view that would be more dramatic, in some ways more mythic and ethereal, and more like landscape painting.
Like a painter, he shaped what he saw. He called himself an artist and boasted to a reporter.
For some of his views, the artist has cut down trees by the score that interfered with the cameras, had himself lowered by ropes down precipices, has gone to points where his packers refused to follow him and carried his apparatus himself rather than forego the picture on which he has set his mind. There's a kind of detached Darwinian objectifying scientist at work, and then there's this sort of rather kind of crazed, death-wish-filled man who'll hang off the side of rock faces to try and get the shot he wants.
He knew he was doing something special.
For artistic effect and careful manipulation, they are pronounced by all the best landscape painters and photographers in the city to be the most exquisite photographic views ever produced on this coast.
He may have been making beautiful photographs that would be shown in London and Paris and New York and at World's Fairs. But it was still the Wild West, and he was still going places very few white men had been. there's always a kind of dark, solitary loneliness. Emotionally, it's very distinct. You can see that he likes chaos, he likes uncertainty, he likes instability. There's often lots of wreckage of trees and broken rocks in the foreground. You're often standing on a precipice where even the photographs can give you vertigo. I think a Darwinian vision of landscape where you don't have a sense of a divine order. That's very much a hallmark of his work.
And of course, he knew what would sell. The wilderness was fashionable.
What they were doing was really creating this imagery that inspired people to come to California.
Marketing.
Yes, absolutely marketing. For example, Muybridge's stereo views were made hundreds and thousands of copies, and they were sold all over the country, all over the world.
This fascination with wilderness, with landscape, this was going on side by side with the development of the railways and the telegraph.
Yeah.
Here is San Francisco in a moment of extraordinary transformation.
He's absolutely fascinated by cities, and he makes great urban images. He's equally fascinated by wilderness as natural landscapes. And I wonder if part of his intensity was his understanding that everything here was going to change. It went from being an incredibly remote place when he got here in 1855 to a place that the railroad connected with the East in 1869.
So the population must have increased multi-fold.
Very dramatically.
Buildings going up, fields being paved over, Native Americans being replaced by tourists. Muybridge was there as the modern world was born.
There's an amazing picture he takes on the railroad where a group of Indians is looking at him, and the one in the center is pulling his bow, so he's firing on the photographer and thereby the viewer. They're defiant. He photographs people in Alaska. They're not victims and they're not vermin. He doesn't take two of the standard American positions at the time.
It was the beginning of the age of anxiety. Muybridge helped usher it in, and was himself under its shadow.
You're not looking directly at the camera, you're looking maybe at that oak in the distance there.
In 1872, he posed for a photograph under a giant redwood tree.
There needs to be tension in those hands, I think.
Yes.
Whatever you feel more comfortable with.
Uncomfortable with, yeah. Okay.
Indeed. One, two, three.
This is Muybridge, just after he'd finished photographing in Yosemite Valley. It's a wonderful portrait because
it's an extraordinary portrait. I mean, he seems very introspective here at this point.
Yeah, he's almost crouched into the corner there, looking very uncomfortable. You know, people at this time that spoke of him said he was a man who would stand no trifling, was an way he was described, and I think
he doesn't look like he'd be trifled with.
Now, his wife was somewhat flirtatious, 20 years younger. And they just got married, so you can imagine a man who could not stand trifling and a woman who was flirtatious, a formula for disaster.
This was the year that would shape his life. First, there was the marriage to Flora, a retoucher at his studio. At just 19, she was already a married woman when they met. It was Muybridge who paid for her divorce. And secondly, Muybridge met the man who would be the patron of the work for which he is most remembered, the railway magnate, Governor Leland Stanford. Stanford loved power and speed, and he owned one of the fastest horses in the country. This is the man who transformed the West by joining the coasts of America together by rail. He saw a horse as a machine and wanted to know how it worked. The story goes that he bet a financier £25,000 that at one instant during the stride, all 4 feet of a trotting horse were off the ground at once. Whether he made that bet or not, he was determined to find out, and Muybridge was the man he asked to do it.
Muybridge's first experiment with Leland Stanford's fast trotter, Occident, the California Wonder he was called, took place in a race course in Sacramento.
When Leland Stanford first approached Muybridge and asked if he could photograph a racing horse at great speed, Muybridge said he couldn't do it. But it was really beyond the technology of photography at the time to stop motion. But Muybridge did agree he would try. He obtained all the bed sheets he could get, and he created a white background covering the track itself with white substance to reflect as much light as possible back onto the running horse.
Wow.
And he set up his camera, and I think the first attempts didn't work at all. He had to actually create a kind of a shutter that would open and close the lens quickly enough to, you know, begin to stop motion.
So how does he then get the idea for the shutter?
Well, the idea of instantaneous photography, of actually stopping motion with a camera, had been around for a while. Muybridge was well aware of the experiments in England and France. He began experimenting with different kinds of shutters.
The artist, having studied the matter thoroughly, contrived to have two boards slip past each other by touching a spring, and in so doing, to leave an eighth of an inch opening for the 500th of a second as the horse passed by.
The photograph didn't survive, but according to Muybridge, he was able to prove with his photograph that probably wasn't distinct at all, that Occident ran with all four of its hoofs off the ground at the same time.
He boasted.
The artist is as proud of his discovery as the governor is of the picture taken.
But later he admitted,
it was shadowy and indistinct. I lost.
So the race was far from won when the experiments were interrupted by something even more dramatic. Muybridge and his young wife, Flora, were living in South Park, an elegant suburb of San Francisco. But Muybridge was often away working.
We never had any trouble to speak of. We sometimes had little disputes about money matters, but they were not serious. I was always a man of very simple tastes and few wants, and I did not spend much money. What I had left over after paying my little expenses, I gave to her, and yet she was always wanting more. I could never see that she had bought anything with it to speak of, or imagine what she did with it. We sometimes had little spats about money, but nothing serious. Nothing more than married people have every day, and then forget the next.
There was one problem he did not mention, a Major Harry Larkins.
I did not fancy the Major's style of man.
But Flora did. She had a baby, whom they called Florado Helios Muybridge. But at the midwife's house, Muybridge found a photo of the baby, inscribed Little Harry.
When I told Muybridge of the affair, he cried like a baby,
said the midwife.
Whose baby is that, mine or Larkin's?
I do not know, I replied.
She did tell him she saw Flora
on the bed with her clothes down to her waist, and Larkin sat on the bedside. Major Larkin sent his old shirts to your house. They were sent to the wash with yours, and your wife paid for the washing. In great agony of mind, he wandered about. My opinion is, when he left me, he was insane.
A colleague recalled seeing him in Montgomery Street. He was as white as marble, his lips compressed. I asked, what is it? What's the matter?
You'll find out soon enough.
Hearing that Larkins was beyond Calistoga, 80 miles away, he dashed down to get the Vallejo ferry, which left at 4 o'clock.
Just caught the evening train.
The brand new railway took him right up the Napa Valley.
light had fallen by the time he arrived here in Calistoga. A stable boy told him he could find Larkins at a place called Yellow Jacket Mine. Muybridge asked him to take him there in his horse and rig. En route, Muybridge fired off his pistol. He was practicing.
It was over an hour's fast drive up into the mountains.
Hello?
In Knight's Valley, Muybridge stopped at a ranch to ask directions.
I'm looking for the Yellow Jacket Ranch.
Knight's Valley starts here and sweeps across all the way out to the end here. And that's the beginning of the road that goes to the Yellow Jacket Ranch.
That's quite a journey to make to commit a murder.
Indeed it is.
Larkins came to the door.
My name is Muybridge, and I have a message for you from my wife.
He shot him, an inch below the left nipple.
Stop here. This is the place. That's where it happened.
Larkins staggered from the house to a giant oak tree and fell. To the ladies with whom Larkins had been playing cards, Muybridge said,
I'm sorry this little trouble occurred in your presence.
Muybridge was held in a cell here at Napa for 4 months before his trial. He didn't speak at the trial, but he did talk in his cell to a reporter from the San Francisco Chronicle.
I loved the woman with all my heart and soul, and the revelation of her infidelity was a cruel, prostrating blow to me. Since the shooting, I have been told many things to which I was previously blind. Friends whom I should have expected to inform me when they saw how I was being deceived have now told me all. I do not desire to see her again. They may ransack my record as much as they please, and I defy them to bring anything against me. I have no fear of the result. I feel that I was justified in what I did, and that all right-minded people would justify my action.
At the trial here, the defense was theatrical. Like a clap of thunder in a clear sky came the revelation that his whole life was blasted. He learned that she had been false to him in every way, false even to the extent of palming off upon him as his own, the child of a libertine seducer.
The trial is a great media circus. It's like the OJ trial. His attorney tries to use an insanity defense. All these people come forward to testify about why Muybridge is crazy. He's crazy because he went out on a precipice to have his picture taken. He's crazy because he would turn down lucrative photographic jobs if he didn't think they're artistically meritorious. But they also describe a man who was genuinely troubled, who would have fits and these odd moments, who would lose his train of thought, mood swings and anger.
The summing up sobbed with sentiment. I cannot ask you to send this man back to his happy home. The destroyer has been there and written all over it with the words, desolation, desolation.
The judge tells them that they either have to find him guilty of murder, in which case he probably would have been hung, or they have to find him not guilty by reason of insanity, in which case he probably would have been incarcerated.
And the verdict was, not guilty. At the sound of these last words, a convulsive gasp escaped the prisoner's lips. His lawyer caught him and thus prevented him from falling to the floor. But his body was as limp as a wet cloth. His face was horrifying in its contortions. 15 minutes later, he pulled himself together and walked into the streets. The crowds applauded wildly.
Muybridge becomes the last man in California to be exonerated for a murder he's admitted committing without the insanity defense. It's a jury of husbands, and this really is the Wild West. And the attitude is, well, what's the problem? Poor Flora goes into a decline and dies 9 months to the day after Larkins was shot. Florado gets put in an orphanage.
And whose son is he?
We don't know.
Flora's last words were said to be, "I'm sorry."
I would have wished he could have lived long enough to at least acknowledge the wrong he had done me, and that the act was a justifiable defense of my marital rights.
He catches a boat not long after for Central America and goes on and makes some of the most movingly, moodily beautiful images of his career.
There's a letter from Guatemala from Eduardo Santiago Muybridge.
Yes, it's interesting. He's changed his name again.
Not just Edward James now, Edward St. James.
Instead of those romantic pictures that we saw before, with the clouds and everything, these are much more disturbing to me. They're somewhat haunting. A lot of the figure placements imply some kind of narratives. But the figures are very static.
Yeah.
And on the other side, on the wall there, you see a guy with a machete standing behind someone else. You wonder what that's about. I have another picture where a fellow with an axe is standing on the corner with a fellow sitting with his back to the picture. I think the pictures are wonderful, but the public didn't like them and they didn't sell well. The murder did affect him. I think he psychologically affected him, and I think it's reflected in the images.
Does the whitening of the hair correspond to that moment?
Apparently, his hair turned white right after the murder, within a few months.
The man who had financed Muybridge's defense at the trial was his patron, Leland Stanford. He wanted him alive. Once again, they joined forces to try to capture that elusive image of a horse at high speed. Both were obsessed. One of the horse trainers said that Muybridge wore a slouch hat in the house, smoked many cigarettes, and would not look you in the eyes. A change from the fine-dressed man of before. They set up on Stanford's estate in Palo Alto, now home to the university which bears his name. In 1876, Stanford started buying land here, and before long had 8,000 acres. And this grand barn, home to 800 racehorses, just the carrot crop to feed the colts, covered 60 acres.
Stanford, of course, was a racing man. So
yes.
He loved racing horses.
Harness horses, particularly. His influence on the standardbred racehorse has been imprinted and imprinted for decades, and you can see that in the way standardbreds look.
Can you remember that when Muybridge was making his first photographs, people didn't know how the horse ran. They
That's
couldn't
right.
see it with
exactly.
their eyes.
Exactly. And those photographs are still used in, for horse people for now, as we go through and we understand movement and how to influence right. movement, how to change it and how to develop it. Because good horseback riding is about making the fundamental gaits better.
Muybridge's greatest innovation is that he understood that in order to really analyze motion, you needed to photograph a sequence of images, one after another, fractions of a second apart, and display them in a grid.
So how did he do this?
They constructed a shed, the camera shed, that would enable Muybridge to line up in a row up to 24 cameras. The complicated thing was, how would you trigger the shutters in sequence at the right moment?
Stanford then enlisted the help of his engineers that worked for the Central Pacific Railroad to help devise the technology that would be needed. It's the first electronic shutter. A wire was run across the track, and then when the horse would run along the track, it would break the wire. The circuit would be broken, shutter would trip. So the horse was then tripping the shutter.
A secretary recalled the joy and pleasure when Mr. Muybridge called from the darkroom.
I've got the picture of the horse jumping from the ground.
It's the most exuberant moment on record in Muybridge's life.
At first, people didn't believe it, and Muybridge had to display the negatives. He had to do a lot to convince people that they weren't doctored, that it really was the way horses ran.
Some press were convinced.
A wonderful invention, photographing a racing horse at full speed. A feat in photography.
But others stayed skeptical.
This is a really good example of the disbelieving general public. The satirical cartoon produced by the Illustrated Wasp.
Yes.
Yeah. And it's showing how Muybridge's motion sequence photography was quite shocking to audiences in the 19th century because it was such a new thing. And that's one of the reasons why he had to go on to prove the efficacy of his work by creating the zoopraxiscope and by creating the discs that were projected on it.
And this is it.
The zoopraxiscope was first demonstrated by Muybridge for Leland Stanford here at his home for a few of his friends in Palo Alto. After this was shown publicly, people wrote they really felt the horses had come to life. All that was needed was the puff of steam from the nostrils of the horse to believe that the horse was really there. It's really not cinema. You're only seeing about a half a second worth of a story.
Right.
The horse runs, and then it runs again, and it keeps running. And the sequence of images are taken by different cameras, all in a line, so it's not one point of view, like cinema would be. But it's the first time people saw projected images made from photographs where everybody could see them at once. It was the very first motion picture projection.
I don't think we can ever really truly recreate that and what the impact was on a Victorian audience. His images were projected between 7 and 10 foot high. That's cinematographic kind of proportions.
Everybody before him photographs objects. You photograph a horse, but Muybridge photographs trotting. Photographing verbs, not nouns. And this is the foundation of cinema, this kind of flickering, shifting world of shadows that we live in now. This is the foundational moment out here on the West Coast when it's still the Wild West. There's this crazy photographer with the big beard and the robber baron patron out on the racetracks in the 1870s. And this is where it all begins.
Animals in Motion is a culmination of his project here in Palo Alto.
It was like a film set, with Muybridge as director, Stanford as producer, technicians, crew, actors. And like all films, it ended in a row over credits. The governor claimed the work as his own. Muybridge went on the road with his glass discs and his zoopraxiscope.
This is one of Muybridge's packing crates that he used to transport his equipment back. Muybridge lectured all around the world for 15 years. Just the fact that he potentially paved the way in the public psyche for a new media form of moving image. That cannot be underestimated in terms of the impact that that had.
His lectures required a lot of preparation. In order to show his images on his zoopraxiscope, Muybridge had to have them painted onto the discs.
The photographic images, when they're projected, appeared unnaturally tall and thin. So Muybridge had to revert to art to manipulate his photographic sequences so they were longer, and when they were projected, that meant that they actually appeared realistic.
He was touching up those pictures, he was actually adjusting them, wasn't he?
Yeah, he was turning to art to prove his scientific point with the zoopraxiscope.
I see. And I'll tell that to Jonathan Miller.
Yeah, exactly.
And so I did.
You know, you have something in common with Muybridge, Jonathan, in that this threshold between art and science is something that you have stepped into all your life.
Yes, but for him there was no threshold because I don't think there was any science which interested him at all.
You're not very flattering about Muybridge.
It's not that I'm not impressed by what he did, but the extent to which he understood or even was interested in the mechanism of movement and how it worked is very questionable. It's an impressive inventory of pictures, some of which are slightly dishonest in that there are things which are...
He cheated
a lot. It isn't that I disapprove of it, it just is that it was not what, in fact, he is credited with, which is the idea of introducing the pictorial representation of movement, and nor did he invent moving pictures. There were lots of people working on what ultimately became the cinema, and also there were much more significant contributions to the understanding of movement introduced by this extraordinary French physiologist, Etienne Jules Marais.
But scientists like Marais sought Muybridge out. Marais said he was lost in admiration for Muybridge's work. He said he wanted his aid and support with his own experiments. Muybridge went to Paris to meet him.
Jules-Étienne Marais invented a kind of photograph called the chrono photograph, where he would take a sequence of frames of a figure isolating different phases of a movement and then record them all on the same photographic surface, so you get this overlapping of blurred figures.
Through Marais, Muybridge met many of the leading painters in Paris.
We know that Muybridge gave some lectures in the studio of the academic painter Meissonier, who also concentrated a lot on horses in motion. It seems highly likely that Degas would have gone, because he makes a note in one of his notebooks in 1878 about an article on Muybridge that appeared in a French popular scientific magazine called La Nature. Degas really set himself the challenge of trying to represent the figure in motion, the figure moving through space. And we see it quite early on with this sculpture of a horse by Degas. As you know, Degas sculpted many horses. It was one of his primary subjects, which is absolutely based on a Muybridge sequence of photographs. When we come to one of Degas' most famous sculptures, The Little Dancer, of which he made about 1879-80, just around the time, or very shortly after he discovered Muybridge, we find that he does a whole series of drawings looking at the figure from a whole range of different viewpoints. He's kind of tracking the figure moving round. He probably would not have got to that stage, or maybe not so early on, without the influence of Muybridge.
I suspect that Degas might have got it right in any case. I just think he was a very
brilliant... You're just not prepared to give way, are you?
So you've written here that he was a self-promoting Englishman. He'd begun to redesign his name in an effort to dramatise his supposedly Anglo-Saxon pedigree. A bit of an upstart, you're saying, then?
He discovered this technique and discovered to his delight that it could be commercially exploited and that he could make wide travels across Europe and be greeted by the equivalent of Prince Charles.
So he was an entertainer, but after all, the cinema...
No, I have nothing against it being an entertainer, but as long as we understand that that's mainly what he was.
I propose visiting England for the purpose of inducing some wealthy gentleman to provide funds for completing my investigations of animal motion.
Royal Institution of Great Britain. Extra evening meeting. In March the 13th, 1882. His Royal Highness the Prince of Wales, KGFRS, Vice Patron and Honorary Member in the chair. Edward Muybridge of San Francisco. The attitudes of animals in motion illustrated with the zoopraxiscope. The problem of animal mechanism has engaged the attention of mankind during the entire period of the world's history.
While the philosopher was exhausting his endeavors to expound the laws that control and the elements that affect the movements associated with animal life, the artist seems to have accepted as authentic without further inquiry the pictorial and sculptural representations of moving animals bequeathed from the remote ages of tradition.
Going to these lectures was a popular thing at the time. It was complicated to do because not only did Muybridge have the zoopraxiscope, which needed someone to look after the limelight burner at the back, with two big oxygen and hydrogen cylinders to keep control of, then someone to turn the handle, someone else maybe to focus, and then someone to hand the discs to the projectionist. And on top of all of that, you've got a double slide projector, and Muybridge is there with his little metal clicker for changing the slides, click, 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 and the projection is set. He was sometimes clicking much faster than I could actually change the slides. So we know it was quite a snappy lecture.
At a future time, the pathologist, the anatomist, and other explorers for hidden truth will find it indispensable for their complex investigations.
I should like to see your boxing picture, said the Prince of Wales to Mr. Muybridge, and promptly there was thrown upon the screen two athletes who pounded away at one another right merrily, to the infinite delight of the audience in general, and the Prince of Wales in particular.
It wasn't scientific, but audiences always like that, seeing boxers on the screen, and it was the Prince of Wales.
He'd won over the scientists. Now he moved on to the arts, with a lecture at the Royal Academy.
He was quite a celebrity, and so I think it was a society event. Many of the artists, many of the academicians would have attended. A reviewer in the New York Herald Tribune wrote, "His demonstrations of the inaccuracy of much of ancient and modern art, especially the absurdity of Frith's horses in the picture Derby Day." And I think this caused quite a bit of consternation because Frith was a very highly respected artist at the Royal Academy.
But Muybridge was riding for a fall. Stanford brought out a new book, this time with no mention at all of Muybridge.
He had been booked to give a demonstration at the Royal Society, and they call him in because they're questioning, are you really the author of these photographs? Because this book has just been published in America. The Royal Society no longer want anything to do with him. Muybridge is desperately embarrassed.
This is a huge blow to him. It's like having his life's work taken away from him. The doors of the Royal Society were thus closed against me, and my promising career in London was brought to a disastrous close.
His saviour was the University of Pennsylvania, which became his new patron. It was here that he produced his most extraordinary images, many of them of himself.
He liked to be photographed with a pickaxe, maybe because a pickaxe was the instrument with which you won the West, and Muybridge associated himself with the Wild West.
The cameras, now arranged in a semicircle, were triggered simultaneously. The shots revolve around a single instant in time. It was literally revolutionary.
He was very proud of his body. He calls himself an aging athlete, about 60, when in fact he's 54 years old. This is taken with a series of cameras, and he's got a watering can, and water is one of the main features of this whole project. Muybridge, who was a fabulous technician with a camera, he was so gifted, he could freeze water. Only a camera could do that. Only a camera could make drops of water visible to the eyes. His camera could also stop a body in midair, as if the laws of gravity didn't exist. I think also his love of the waterfalls of Yosemite, the flowing rivers and lakes, I think that gets transported into this work as well.
In his 2 years at the university, Muybridge made 20,000 individual images. The university set up a committee to oversee the scientific accuracy of the work. The grid was something they wanted, in order to measure and compare bodies. As always, Muybridge boasted his scientific intentions.
Here, for the first time, human eyes may see just how the human body moves in the performance of its functions. This is not an art, but it is a mine of facts that no artist can afford to neglect.
But really, something much stranger was going on.
He wanted to photograph his female models in everyday activities, so he said. But actually, he photographed them in little stories like this, ashamed, or engaged in activities that nice women didn't engage in, like smoking. It's very hard to understand what physiological laws are to be found in leaning back in a chair and smoking.
N, nude. When any one figure is nude, the entire series is so classified. SN, semi-nude. The model is clothed with a light or transparent drapery from the waist to the knees. It also includes more or less underclothing. TD, transparent drapery. The model is attired in a flowing garment of diaphanous texture, which permits the actions of the limbs to be seen. How Michelangelo would have reveled in these volumes. Here are dancing girls, graceful enough to delight the soul of Raphael.
There's a movement towards a sort of cheap eroticism as you go on and you see...
You mean all those ladies having water put her with no clothes on?
That's right.
Yes, they're quite saucy, really, aren't they? They are absolutely mind-boggling to watch, and mesmeric to watch. But there's something very clinical about putting naked human bodies up against that grid. It's a very austere laboratory feel to those pictures.
He's interested now in the poetry of motion and the aesthetics, and he's creating these scenes that focus in on little details of how something moves.
How many people, even today, look at those little movements, how we bend, how water falls, all these extraordinary things captured both still and moving, and you can re-look again and again at the same image as you watch them repeat themselves.
I think that the, you know, the kind of obsessiveness of Muybridge's grids creates this visual poetry that then becomes extremely influential in the history of art. This, for example, influences Marcel Duchamp, who painted not long after this the nude descending a staircase, or Francis Bacon, or Andy Warhol in his paintings of images that are created as grids.
It's true that paint-smeared remnants of Muybridge's photographs were to be found in Bacon's studio. And there are figures sprawling, having fallen, to be seen in some of Bacon's pictures, which I suspect were inspired, to some extent at least, by Muybridge.
Muybridge has certainly been repeated by many artists since. Sol LeWitt, for instance, with his homage. Or Stephen Pippin, who turned washing machines into cameras.
The grid is almost the theme of conceptualist art practice in the 60s and 70s. Seriality, repetition, the grid. It's all here.
Philip Glass made the photographer. That's about Muybridge.
You can see his hand in animation, too.
I mean, this is the artist at work here, isn't it? Embellishing.
Well, I think what Muybridge is realising, this is 1893, he's understood that people are much more sophisticated, so he's creating a more interesting narrative for his audiences.
I mean, this is sort of early Walt Disney.
Certainly, when it comes to animation, his work was used, still used by animators. A lot of people who were connected to the early animators have told me that they saw that they had Muybridge's books in their offices. So they would refer to them.
Seems to me, looking back now from a digital age, that he actually goes straight from instantaneous photography in the world of magic lanterns straight through to Photoshop, or his version of Photoshop, and CGI animation, and he sort of misses out cinematography altogether. He's doing what we do now without a computer.
The Matrix is a clever use of Muybridge's technology, and they pretty much set up a sequence of cameras in a semicircle. To be able to move a camera virtually and to place a bullet virtually into the scene. They used his sequence of single photographs and then stitched them all together.
This technique used in The Matrix is now known as time slice photography.
You're empty.
So his influence spirals onwards. But at the time, Muybridge was sidelined. He did actually meet Edison, who is often credited as the inventor of cinema. They even discussed linking sound and picture together, the talkies. That wouldn't happen for half a century.
An entire opera will be recorded and reproduced for the instruction and entertainment of an audience, long after the original participants have passed away.
Muybridge carried on showing his photographs with his now rather passé zoopraxiscope. In 1893, he had a whole hall built at the World Fair in Chicago.
It was getting towards the end of his career, and Muybridge's projections were not as popular as the Hoochie Coochie dancers in the tent next door.
In 1894, as the century drew to a close, Muybridge moved back to Kingston, declaring himself not American, but English. The very next year, the first films astounded the public. Muybridge did fight back when he heard it said that Edison was the first to bring still pictures to life on screen.
Demonstrations of a similar character were made so long ago that one may reasonably be excused for having forgotten about them.
One clue to who Muybridge is that he never really photographed people in a serious way, close up. He begins to work with ideas about motion. It was a way for him to move away from the real world and into a more conceptual world that was really dealing with ideas that were completely new.
He must be a strange man, mustn't he? I mean, how would we diagnose it? I mean, the human face moves, but he didn't want to go there.
Muybridge wasn't interested in that aspect of humanity. I think that he was very much detached from other people. And, you know, I wish I could have known Muybridge to understand who he was.
Entrepreneur, always looking for sponsorship, showman, photographer, not quite scientists, not quite artists. He just doesn't fit.
And murderer.
And murderer. Well, he was acquitted.
Drama next tonight on BBC One and BBC One HD. Julie Christie plays a woman who develops Alzheimer's disease in her film Away From Her.